To the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
And there is much more ahead starting at 8. Let's find out what's ahead if you're driving along the Dumbarton Bridge with Mel Baker now.
Be prepared for some slow traffic 84 westbound between the High Rise and University Avenue on the peninsula. On the San Mateo Bridge, it's slow to stop and go pretty much all the way across westbound from the Interpretive Center to Mariners Island Boulevard. The connecting southbound 880 in San Lorenzo is stop and go from 238 down to Stevenson Boulevard in Fremont. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health to deliver exceptional orthopedic care in the North Bay. Leading specialists in arthritis, joint replacement, spine, hand, elbow, and more. UCSFHealth.org/MarinHealth. Member-supported KQED-FM 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI-FM 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento. If you have a smart speaker, ask it to play KQED. I'm Dave Freeman at 8 o'clock.
Good morning. President Biden's new executive order bans most asylum seekers from entering the U.S., but for many Democrats, the order goes too far. We'll hear from California Senator Alex Padilla in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, there's gold in our hills. Vice President Harris came for it yesterday. Donald Trump comes today.
Also, members of Congress are required by law to disclose when they buy or sell stocks. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. There are products that track those trades, and they often outperform the market, so does that undermine the point of the law? Also, educators are sounding the alarm on the rising number of chronic student absences. And after 40 years on Wheel of Fortune, the daytime show's longtime host Pat Sajak makes his final spin. It's Thursday, June 6th. Actor Robert Englund, a.k.a. Freddy Krueger, is 77 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden and other world leaders are marking the 80th anniversary of the World War II invasion known as D-Day. They're holding ceremonies in Normandy, France. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Biden met dozens of World War II veterans today, including more than 30 who stormed the beaches on D-Day.
In his remarks, Biden nodded to the reality that with many of these veterans more than 100 years old, their voices may be lost to time.
We cannot let what happened here be lost in the silence of the years to come. We must remember it, must honor it, and live it. And we must remember the fact that they were heroes here that day does not absolve us from what we have to do today.
Democracy is never guaranteed, he said, and every generation must fight for it. Biden referenced the fight happening today in Ukraine as it tries to defend itself from Russia and its expansionist aims. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Colville-sur-Mer, France.
The private company SpaceX says its mammoth rocket Starship has successfully completed its short flight today into space. The rocket took off from its base in southern Texas, and SpaceX mission managers cheered when the Starship successfully splashed down in the Indian Ocean.
Starship is in landing zone.
Landing zone, ship.
This was SpaceX's fourth launch of a Starship. Two of them blew up after lifting off. The third rocket got into space, but it disintegrated when it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. NASA and Boeing's Starliner capsule is in orbit, speeding toward the International Space Station. That launched yesterday from Florida with two astronauts aboard. It's the Starliner's first crewed launch. The program has been delayed for years by technical issues. Atlanta officials have announced they've lifted a boil water advisory. A major water main broke last Friday and other mains ruptured over the weekend. The water outages halted surgeries in hospitals and forced some Atlanta residents to boil water or drink bottled water for nearly a week. From member station WABE, Lily Oppenheimer has more.
Crews worked overtime to excavate and replace the corroded pipes. Some were more than 80 years old, according to Atlanta's Department of Watershed Management. Now officials say they've fully restored the system. Mayor Andre Dickens has promised to ask for more federal aid to make sure Atlanta's infrastructure keeps up with the city's booming population. He's facing criticism for the lack of communication during the first 24 hours of the crisis. But Atlanta's not alone in its aging system, with a recent Utah State University study showing about a third of water mains in the U.S. and Canada are more than 50 years old. For NPR News, I'm Lily Oppenheimer in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up about 40 points. The NASDAQ is up more than 13. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. Four firefighters battling a wildfire in northern Napa County were hospitalized yesterday. State fire officials say the firefighters on the Crystal Fire were treated and released. They sustained injuries related to the steep rocky terrain the fire has been burning in and the hot temperatures on Wednesday afternoon. CAL FIRE says it reached triple digits in the area. The vegetation fire between Calistoga and St. Helena sent up a significant amount of smoke, prompting air regulators to issue an advisory. The 60-acre fire is 75% contained. It scorched part of an area burned by the massive and destructive glass fire in 2020. San Francisco officials are scheduled to meet tomorrow with the union representing Muni Transit operators to try to resolve a dispute over a new contract. KQED's Dan Brecky reports.
Muni bus drivers and train operators, members of Transport Workers Union Local 250A, recently voted down an offer for a 13% salary increase over the next 3 years. That's the same increase that seven other bargaining units at the city's Municipal Transportation Agency have already tentatively agreed to. Citing tough working conditions, the operators are holding out for nearly 17%. The SFMTA says that would increase the contract's cost by $21 million at a time the agency is facing huge deficits. The operator's contract expires June 30th. With no agreement by then, the city could face a transit strike. I'm Dan Brecky, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at kqed.org.
Support for NPR comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to shorten the gap between cancer research and cancer care. Learn more about Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery at danafarber.org/everywhere. And by the listeners and members of KQED. Mel, with traffic at 8:06 this time, we're talking Dunbarton Bridge.
Where traffic is a little slow from the high rise to the other end of the bridge. I'm going to jump up to the North Bay now to Novato, where we have an unexpectedly slow spot of traffic southbound between Highway 37 and about Miller Creek Road. It's nearly stopped. Slow down to Central San Rafael, 37 westbound from Mare Island Bridge to lane merge. That's stop and go. There's a lot of heavy traffic, though, out to Sears Point. Mel Baker for KQED.
And traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction this morning. KQED News with Brian Watt at 8:22. As Pride celebrations get underway across the Bay Area, we're going to look at the queer nightlife renaissance taking place in downtown Oakland. That's coming up at 8:22 on KQED. Bay Area weather slowly cooling down along the coast and bay. The cool spots right now, mid-60s to the 70s to low 80s around the Bay shoreline. A little cooler, but still warm to hot well inland. Today's highs in the low 90s inland. The heat advisory ends tonight around midnight. Still hot in the Sacramento Valley. The National Weather Service says the excessive heat warning in effect until 8 this evening. Sunny, warm to hot weather today with some hot gusty winds around 25 miles per hour. Today's highs 94 to 104 around the Sacramento Valley. Tomorrow, highs will range from 89 to 99.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Heavy fighting in central Gaza has left at least 140 Palestinians dead over the last 2 days. That according to a hospital director there who spoke with NPR. The new bombardments include an overnight airstrike by Israel on a UN facility sheltering displaced families.
Here's how an aid worker for Doctors Without Borders describes a scene in central Gaza.
The situation is apocalyptic. This morning on my way to the hospital, I saw two donkeys carrying the bodies of at least 8 people who had died.
This is happening despite U.S. calls for Israel and Hamas to agree to a ceasefire originally proposed by Israel.
We're going to go now to NPR's Kat Lomsdorf, who is in Tel Aviv. Hello, Kat.
Hey, Michelle.
So what have you been hearing about what's going on in Gaza?
Yeah, so in the past few days, Israeli troops have launched a new offensive in central Gaza. Israel's military says its air force is striking Hamas and that its ground troops are operating in a limited manner. But from what we've heard from people on the ground, including our producer, Anas Baba, that area has been pummeled with Israeli airstrikes and artillery in the past 2 days. And just a reminder, these areas are in central Gaza are where many people have fled in recent weeks from Rafah in the south. That aid worker we just heard, Karen Huster, who called it apocalyptic, she sent us that voice note on Wednesday before the Israeli airstrike last night on the UN facility.
Do we know any more about that strike? What can you tell us?
Yeah, this morning, Anas, our producer, spoke to us from that UN school that had been hit. He said the school is sheltering displaced families. One he heard about had reached the school just 2 weeks ago, and the entire family was killed while they were sleeping. Anas described walking up the school staircase, which was covered in blood, and he saw severely injured children. The Israeli military put out a statement this morning saying that that strike was, quote, precise, and that a Hamas compound had been embedded in the school with people who had been involved in the October 7th attacks on Israel. The military also said that a number of steps were taken to reduce the risk of harming uninvolved civilians.
You know, just last week, President Biden unveiled what he called an Israeli plan for a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. What's the status of that?
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come out and said that what Biden unveiled was not, quote, complete, and insisted Israel would carry on until it has destroyed Hamas both as a military and governing force. Netanyahu has a delicate balancing act between pressure from the U.S. and his own coalition here in Israel, made up in part by far-right politicians who are demanding the total annihilation of Hamas. They have openly threatened to bring down his government if he doesn't stick to their demands. And, you know, there are efforts in Doha to get talks restarted, but they just really don't seem to be going anywhere. Hamas originally responded positively to that plan that Biden put forth last week, but now they're signaling that they won't agree to it unless Israel says it will end the war completely.
I want to talk more about those sort of those elements in Israeli politics. The far right has become an important player in the past few years. And yesterday, Israeli nationalists made a show of strength in a parade through Jerusalem. Talk more about that, if you would.
Yeah, so this was a celebration of a national holiday here called Jerusalem Day. It's a parade that happens every year. It marks when Israel effectively annexed East Jerusalem in 1967. I was at the march yesterday, and it's tens of thousands of people showed up waving Israeli flags, singing and dancing. You know, they say it's just a celebration to show that Israel claims all of Jerusalem. But we heard marchers shouting things like death to Arabs. And for Palestinians, it's very provocative. And, you know, it should be noted that those far-right members of Netanyahu's cabinet, the ones who are against this ceasefire deal, many of them were there.
That is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf from Tel Aviv. Kat, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
President Biden's new executive order makes it harder for asylum seekers to enter the U.S. Yesterday, we heard from Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who defended the policy. Today, we're going to hear from a member of the president's own party who thinks it goes too far. That's Senator Alex Padilla. He's a Democrat from California, and he chairs the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Citizenship, and Border Safety. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Senator, you issued a statement calling this Trump's asylum ban. You said that by reviving Trump's asylum ban, President Biden has undermined American values and abandoned our nation's obligations to provide people fleeing persecution, violence, and authoritarianism with an opportunity to seek refuge in the United States. So, you know, obviously you disagree with that. Secretary Mayorkas says this is not Trump's ban. This is different. You disagree.
Well, there are some minor differences, but the fundamental framework of this executive order is very, very close to what was tried and failed during the Trump administration. And that's one of my frustrations with both this executive order, the bipartisan bill that was negotiated in the Senate a few months ago. Nobody's asking who is coming to the southern border, where are they coming from, and most importantly, why are they coming? In many cases, it's people fleeing persecution. It's people fleeing authoritarian regimes, the very types of conditions that why we have an asylum system to begin with. So unless we start paying attention to the root causes of migration and addressing them, we're not going to stem the flow.
Well, so let me dig into a couple of things here. First of all, you raise a moral objection. You say that this is out of alignment with American values and at least President Biden's stated values. But your second objection, as you've just described it here and as you described in your statement, is that it won't work. It just won't work. Why do you say it just won't work?
Well, again, we can build a wall as high as we want, or we can make it as impossible as we can try to for people to qualify for asylum, but the root causes, the reason so many people come to the United States seeking asylum, are going to continue to be there. So there's a smarter, more effective way to go about it, including engaging partners in not just Mexico, but in Central and South America. This really is a hemispheric challenge that requires a hemispheric solution. And here's my frustration with the Republicans. They point to the border and call it a crisis, yet they continue to deny the very departments and agencies charged with managing the border of the resources they need to manage it more effectively. And here's another little known fact. The numbers these last couple of months have actually reduced significantly. The numbers of people coming to the southern border have gone down. Why? Because the administration officials have engaged partners in the Mexican government to manage it together, and it's been successful.
You all talked about the need for more resources to improve the infrastructure for receiving migrants and for adjudicating their claims, whether they're legitimate asylum claims or not. I mean, the administration says, and Secretary Mayorkas said this yesterday, that they were working with Congress and that Republicans walked away from the deal. Democrats say it's because President Trump told them to. Others say that the deal was inadequate. But in any case, the administration says they've tried working with Congress. Congress, at least its current form, is unwilling. This is the best that they can do. You just don't buy it.
Well, look, I am definitely not in the camp of do nothing. And I know the president feels like he needs to do something. I just wish it was something more thoughtful and more strategic. But ultimately, the solutions do lie with Congress. Just to pick an arbitrary number and say the border is going to close after, you know, 2,500 people may show up in a particular day, just violates, from a human rights perspective, the asylum seeker who was next in line. What we should be doing to reduce the wait time between people requesting asylum and their final determination is hiring more immigration judges, more hearing officers, building the capacity of that system get their answer in a matter of weeks, not years.
I understand that. But the administration is saying that they can't do that without the budgetary authority from Congress. So I'm asking you, within their executive authority, you said you're not in the camp of doing nothing. What could President Biden do within the scope of his executive authority that you think would be superior to what he's now done?
Well, again, there's already some success that we should all recognize, that the numbers of people approaching the southern border have declined significantly in the last couple of months without a bill being passed, without an executive order being signed. It's because we've engaged the government of Mexico south of the border to address the migration challenge together. We need to build on that with partners in Central and South America to do it even more so. But ultimately, the final solution does lie with Congress.
That is Alex Padilla. He is a United States Senator, a Democrat, and he represents California. He's also the chair of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Citizenship, and Border Safety. Senator Padilla, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Much of the western U.S. is experiencing extreme heat this week, with temperatures blazing past 100 degrees. A phenomenon known as a heat dome is to blame. NPR's Bill Chappell has more.
If you want to visualize how a heat dome can trap a region in intensely hot weather, picture yourself making a sandwich.
If you've made grilled cheese in a pan and you put a lid on there, it melts the cheese faster because the lid helps trap the heat. It's a similar concept here. You get a big high-pressure system in the upper parts of the atmosphere, and it allows that heat to build underneath.
That's Alex Lamers of the National Weather Service. He's the operations branch chief at the Weather Prediction Center. Lamers says a heat dome can cook an area for days, sometimes weeks. The heat dome that's currently putting a hot lid on the southwest U.S. will bring highs that are 20 to 30 degrees hotter than normal for early June. Thursday's forecast has both Phoenix and Las Vegas hitting 112 degrees, and the heat will stick around at night, falling only to the low 80s. As of late Wednesday, more than 20 million Americans from California to Texas were living under a federal excessive heat advisory.
We are bracing already here in Tucson.
That's Jo Ellen Russell, a climate scientist and distinguished professor at the University of Arizona. Her city is forecast to hit 109 degrees. Russell says this is a classic heat dome. So, what's causing it? The jet stream is moving farther north than normal, leaving stagnant high-pressure systems that heat up the southwest. Both Russell and Lamers warn that heat waves are killers and that they're increasingly common.
They are more frequent and they last longer. It's not the first day of the heat wave that kills you. It's the third or the fourth.
And while the daytime highs make headlines, Lamer says to beware if nights stay too warm to let you cool off.
And we find this a lot, is that the minimum temperatures have a pretty high correlation to fatality rates in these types of events.
It's important, he says, to find ways to stay hydrated and give your body a break from the heat, because until the heat dome lifts, it can feel relentless. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's KQED Public Radio at 8:19. I'm Dave Freeman, and Brian Watt coming right up with your KQED News on this Thursday morning. Back to Mel. Let's find out about traffic in San Francisco right now.
The 101 northbound connector to 280, they're clearing up from a grass fire that started off the right-hand shoulder there. Traffic is still stop and go back to Bayshore Boulevard. 280 itself is backed up to Mission Street. The left lane is blocked in Hayward on 880 southbound after Whipple Road by a motorcycle crash. Stop and go back to Tennyson. Highway 4 westbound before Port Chicago Highway, the center lane blocked in Concord by a two-car crash. Stop and go there back to Harbor Street. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting company the Tony-winning Best Revival of a Musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works at the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. On KQED today and tomorrow afternoon, don't forget the news quiz at 5:48 p.m. each day. When you hear the quiz question, go to kqed.org/radio-news-quiz. Enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, driverless taxis have become a common sight in San Francisco, even a tourist attraction. But their learning models and the traffic scenarios that confound them have remained a blind spot for California regulators. From long-haul trucking to package delivery, and yes, those Waymo cars, we're talking about autonomous vehicles. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
At 10 on Forum with Leslie McClurg, what does it mean to raise men who feel validated but not entitled? That's among the questions Ruth Whitman considers in her new book, Boy Mom. Forum talks to her about the book and what she calls the age of impossible masculinity. Join us for Forum coming up 9 to 11 today. Cooler weather along the coast and bay for the Bay Area finally. Mid-60s to the low 90s. Well, inland heat advisory ends tonight. Cooler weather tomorrow too, even cooler heading into the weekend. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. More at Indeed.com/NPR. And by the listeners and members of KQED. It's 8:22.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. Pride celebrations are getting underway this month across the Bay Area. And in some places, like downtown Oakland, the parties have been going on year-round. That part of the city has been seeing a renaissance of sorts for queer nightlife. Several brick-and-mortar venues have opened up in recent months, and they're bringing new life to a downtown that's probably better known for store closures and fears about crime and safety. KQED Arts and Culture editor Nastia Voinovskaya talked about all of this on our local news podcast, The Bay, hosted by Erica Cruz Guevara.
Most of these venues are located walking distance from 19th Street BART and 12th Street BART, so you can really do a loop. You can start, you know, at Town Bar, for example, hit the dance floor, maybe see a little drag or one of the other events that they have going on. Then go to Fillmore and have a classy cocktail. Then you can make your way down to Quirico, which is a Latin club. Right across the street from there, there's Nectar Social Club, and they have this huge, diverse array of events, art shows, open mic nights, and dance parties, too.
It seems like you're describing like a scene that is not really just one thing. It's like really a diverse sort of range of like vibes and music and spaces, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Oakland has always been driven by queer people of color and often Black women. With this new explosion of energy, I think it's gotten even more diverse in terms of just different events on any night of the week catering to different gender identities, but also ones that are not just segregated, but really embracing the way that people fluidly identify now.
And I know you talked with some of the owners of these spaces. What did they tell you about why this scene seems to be growing?
During the pandemic, when everything was shut down, many people had the time to think about what they really wanted to do and come up with new avenues for themselves. So just coming out of that, people are really, really hungry to express and connect.
I wanted to create a space that wasn't just a nightclub, that wasn't just a cafe, that wasn't just a small event space, that was a blank canvas and a true third space in its fullest sense that were open daytime to nighttime.
Jeremy Redford, the owner of Nectar Social Club, put it really well.
And you can come here and do everything from launch a new creative project to chat up the bartenders and make friends, or come dance until 2 a.m. and, you know, bring out all your friends and have the time of your life.
With a lot of storefronts still sitting empty, people also ended up activating sort of unconventional spaces like where Nectar Social Club is. It may not be, if you just looked at it, you may not see it as the typical place that would hold a bar and a venue. It's this very kind of like narrow, skinny bar, and it's very, very intimate. And with that, you know, they're able to have these more experimental events because it's a pretty small space and it can just feel very full when 50 people are there dancing.
Well, I want to talk now, Sia, more about the need that these spaces are filling. And I know you spoke with someone named Montana Hooks, who's the creator behind Queer in Oakland. Can you tell me a little bit about her and her role in the scene?
So Montana Hooks is the creator of this platform called Queer in Oakland.
As Queer in Oakland, I started throwing events probably in like 2018.
It's an online publication where she interviews and writes about queer culture makers, mostly folks of color. And then she says that with all these new brick and mortar spaces, some of which are queer owned, but don't necessarily build themselves as exclusively queer, but that there's more visibility than there has been in a while.
As we're becoming stronger as a queer community, I feel like that we can take up space now in ways that less marginalized communities don't even have to give a second thought.
You really see that at her events where like people are dancing and it has this very intimate energy, and she's been building a lot of really exciting momentum.
I often want to cry, and I'm not even joking, because it's just so beautiful and I love seeing everyone's smiling faces. I love watching people meet. It's all so beautiful.
How are you also thinking about this story in the context of the mainstream narrative around Oakland right now?
Yeah, I mean, Oakland definitely has its challenges and we should acknowledge that. But I do get frustrated when people just exclusively focus on this doom loop narrative, because if you go out in Oakland and meet people and are open, you really meet some of the most determined and heartfelt and community-oriented people that you will meet. There's always this really inspiring energy in Oakland where people are trying to uplift and support each other through their creative passions. And that's the thing I love most about it. Queer and trans people of color have always been leading the way in that in Oakland. So with this story, I just really wanted to pay homage to that and uplift the people that are actually making positive things happen rather than this constant negative narrative about our town.
That was KQED's arts and culture editor, Nastia Wojnowskaya, speaking with Erica Cruz Guevara, the host of our local news podcast, The Bay. You can find the show on your favorite podcast apps. Look for The Bay. And you can learn more about the queer nightlife scene in Oakland at kqed.org/arts. I'm Brian Watt. Just going to sit in this groove for a couple of seconds. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
It's 8:29. Let's find out about traffic up in the North Bay with Mel, more specifically Santa Rosa.
Highway 12 eastbound between E Street and Mission Boulevard stop and go right now. It's slow on 101 northbound between Yolanda and College Avenue through the 12 interchange. Southbound from Mark West Springs Road down to about Mendocino Avenue. Be prepared for slow traffic. Slows again down toward Corby. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED on Thursday comes from Brevo. Growing businesses can choose Brevo as their marketing platform to help cultivate lasting customer relationships. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com. Sacramento still hot, a little cooler today, much cooler tomorrow. Highs 94 to 104 today. The heat warning ends tonight at 8. Tomorrow's highs 89 to just under 100. Cooler towards the weekend, too. And the Bay Area cooler today, mid-60s along the coast, low 90s inland. It is now 8:30.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. 80 years ago today, more than 150,000 U.S., British, Canadian, and other Allied forces, backed by thousands of ships and landing craft, stormed the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. It was a crucial turning point in World War II. Today, crowds of people, including the remaining few veterans still alive to tell their stories, are paying tribute. World leaders are attending vigils, commemorations, and ceremonies. President Biden vowed NATO solidarity in the face of another threat on European soil, Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
The United States and NATO and a coalition of more than 50 countries standing strong with Ukraine. We will not walk away.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's attending events. Russian President Vladimir Putin was snubbed. The European Union is holding parliamentary elections over the next 4 days. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports on the emergence or revival of a range of parties and varied results.
What is clear amongst all of these varied political results is that big parties that have made up mainstream politics for decades in Europe are losing votes, making way for a bigger variety of parties.
NPR's Rob Schmitz reporting. The Dow is up 73 points. The S&P's down 2. Nasdaq's off 31. It's NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Former President Donald Trump is set to attend a big-ticket fundraiser in San Francisco today, 1 week after he was convicted of 34 felony counts. The event is drawing on support from Silicon Valley, as we hear from KQED's Scott Schaefer.
The event will be held at the San Francisco home of venture capitalist David Sacks, with a top price of $500,000 per couple. Republican National Committeewoman Harmeet Dillon says she's attending the sold-out event. Dillon, whose firm has represented Trump and others who falsely claim the 2020 election was stolen, says while tech executives often align with Democrats on social issues, this is about their bottom line.
I don't think this is a sudden conversion to every tenet of MAGA, if you will. It is business leaders voting their personal and their business's interests.
After San Francisco, Trump heads to Southern California for more fundraising events there. I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED News.
Levels of COVID in Bay Area wastewater are continuing to rise as this year's summer swell appears to be arriving early. KQED's Carly Severn has more.
Stanford's wastewater scan team says COVID numbers are up at 82% of the sites they monitor locally, mirroring an upward trend nationally. Across the country, COVID wastewater levels are now in the high category. COVID levels are especially pronounced in San Francisco's two wastewater sites, where the Stanford team says it's seeing some of the highest concentrations it's ever measured. Last year, the seasonal summer swell didn't start until late June. People 65 and older remain eligible for an extra vaccine dose this summer. However, only 36% of this age group in California are up to date on their vaccines. I'm Carly Seven, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt, more at kqed.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from Style Bath & Kitchen, providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower, or bathtub, and more in their new video series, available on their website by searching Style Bath & Kitchen online. One last spin of the Wheel of Fortune with Pat Sajak coming up. After more than 40 years, Sajak's long run as host of Wheel of Fortune ends tomorrow. The new host is Ryan Seacrest. Morning Edition with the details coming up, along with your California report. Support for NPR comes from Uma, cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And by Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And the listeners, members, and sustainers of KQED. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. It's 8:35.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. One of the major issues this year in education has been the alarming number of students who have missed 15 days or more of school. Some states have seen chronic absenteeism soar to more than 40% of their students. Educators are sounding alarm bells, but parents, according to a new NPR Ipsos poll, don't see yet the urgency. NPR education reporter Sequoia Carrillo has a story.
When asked to define the term chronic absenteeism, only about one in three parents in our poll could pick the right definition. Cecilia Leong says she isn't surprised.
It's easy to hear the definition that chronic absence is missing 10% of the school year and not translate it into everyday reality.
Leong is the vice president of programs at AttendanceWorks, a nonprofit that researches school attendance. She says absenteeism is sneaky. It creeps up on parents. A student only has to miss 2 days of school a month to end up chronically absent, so parents often don't see it happening. In the years since 2020, the number has ballooned.
We went from 8 million students to over 14.6 million chronically absent.
Arizona, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. have all seen absenteeism rates above 40% in recent years. The problem has aligned with historic drops in reading and math scores nationwide. Chronic absence has also long been a predictor of student dropout rates. Administrators are launching door knocking or text campaigns in efforts to bring students back, but parents aren't quite there yet, especially since the COVID shutdown.
Before the pandemic, like the sniffles or his allergies or if he got sick, I'm like, he can still go to school, give him some Tylenol, he's good.
Maritza Hernandez lives in Phoenix with her three children. Two are still in school, one is 7 and the other is 18. Her youngest struggles with bad allergies during parts of the year.
After the pandemic, I'm like, oh no, I can't stay in school because you might get somebody else sick. I don't know if this is just allergies or it might be worse.
She's a single mom and says even when her kids are well, things just start to stack up in the morning.
I'm guilty. I'm one of those parents that take my kids late mostly every day, every day. And sometimes they're marked absent.
She calls the school or takes the time to go check them in at the office. But she's normally waiting in a long line of parents to get a late pass, often making the kids even more tardy. Even when parents see absenteeism as a problem, they don't always see it as their problem. According to the NPR Ipsos poll, only 6% of parents surveyed identified their child as chronically absent, but the numbers nationwide show a disconnect.
Prior to the pandemic, it was just under about 15% of students would meet the definition of chronic absenteeism, and that rate grew to nearly 30% in the 21-22 school year.
Thomas Dee is an education professor at Stanford University. He's studied chronic absence after the pandemic and the resulting dip in test scores.
One very prominent explanation here that meets the evidence is that during the pandemic, many children and parents simply began to see less value in regular school attendance.
Scholars call it norm erosion. Essentially, students and parents fell out of the habit of school.
What I'm not going to do here today is parent blame, right?
they have a lot of other issues that they're facing.
Nicole Weiglandowski teaches elementary school in Philadelphia and knows that attendance is never a cut and dry issue.
My kids are missing school because we live in an area with bad air quality, right? So their asthma acts up and they're not sure if it's their asthma or if it's their allergies or if it's COVID.
She says that combined with things like housing insecurity, transportation issues, having little siblings who need to stay home and receive care, all result in more students staying home. Our poll asked parents about all kinds of issues facing K-12 education, and chronic absenteeism ranked last out of 12 topics, including bullying, gun violence, book bans, and others. Only 5% of parents and the general population saw it as a top worry. Their highest priority? Preparing students for the future. Mallory Newell, a vice president at Ipsos, sees potential there.
To prepare students adequately for the future, they need to be in the classroom. I think that could be a really effective and important linkage for parents that maybe parents and the public just aren't making quite yet.
Experts say outreach and identifying the reasons keeping students out of the classroom is the best chance districts have of getting their students back. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
Game show contenders won't be buying a vowel from Pat Sajak anymore.
After more than 40 years, Sajak's final spin on Wheel of Fortune is tomorrow. Here he is on day one, way back in December of 1981.
And now, here's your new host, Pat Sajak.
As Jack mentioned, my name is Pat Sajak, and I've been fortunate enough to wander onto the set of a very successful program.
Well, I suppose doing anything for 40 years is fairly unusual.
That's Robert Thompson. He is a professor at Syracuse University who teaches a class on pop culture and television.
It is especially unusual in television, where most shows don't last anywhere near that long.
Thompson says Sajak's decades-long run is partly due to the success of the show itself and Sajak's old-school style of hosting.
A game show host is someone you're potentially going to be watching a half hour a day for 5 days a week. There has to be sort of all the edges kind of off. You want them to have a personality, but it can't be the kind of personality you grow tired of.
In 2014, some fans did grow tired of Sajak when the self-described conservative Republican tweeted that, quote, global warming alarmists were unpatriotic racists. His spokesman later said it was a joke.
Personal politics aside, jokes were a big part of Sajak's hosting style, especially in moments where contestants would give some pretty off-the-wall answers.
A group of pill pushers?
This is Wheel of Fortune, y'all!
Thompson says credit for the show's long-running success is also due to its co-host Vanna White and her rapport with Sajak.
We all goof around here on the set. We're all like family. And
we're very lucky.
That.
We have a very, really nice group of men and women here. We like them all. Well, except for, you know, that one you always complain about. But other than that, we like everybody.
Whatever you want to call it, Abbott and Costello, he was able to do a bit with Vanna day after day that most of the other game show hosts did not have.
Vanna White's new co-host is TV and radio presenter Ryan Seacrest. And Thompson says don't expect to see major changes to the game show. It works well, just as it is.
If you look at the TV shows that have come and gone, a show like Wheel of Fortune keeps plugging away. That should tell us about some very basic things of the nature of human entertainment that I don't think we give nearly the credit.
But as we know, it is the host who keeps things moving, right, eh?
Absolutely. That's what we're hosting for. This is NPR News.
And now on KQED, we have to find out if traffic is moving along. Here's Mel Baker.
Not so well in San Bruno. 380 eastbound between just after El Camino Real. Traffic is stop and go back to 280 by a two-car crash that's mostly on the shoulder. 101 northbound into San Francisco begins to back up at Bayshore Boulevard in Brisbane and stays that way all the way up to the hospital curve. The central freeway is very heavy right now. Mel Baker. Or KQED.
Now 8:43, I'm Dave Freeman with a KQED perspective. Good morning. As a second-generation Asian American, it was much easier for Knives Nguyen to come out to their friends at school than to their mom. Why our media brings their perspective.
Do you know what a bisexual person is? With a racing heart and a lump in my throat, I told her, that's who I am. I came out to my mom in middle school. Even though she immigrated here from Vietnam as a teenager and speaks perfect English, I wasn't sure if she had ever heard of the term bisexual before. Like my sexuality, my life has always felt split in two. Who I get to be when I'm at school and who I am when I'm at home. In high school, I was openly queer and supported our small but mighty gay community. But at home, my exploration of androgyny was met with hostility from my father and disappointment from my mother. One especially tense day, my father told me I needed to change how I looked or else he would throw out all of my clothes and replace them with skirts and dresses. A female gender was a performance I had to keep up at home, and I was failing. Hair was another source of conflict in my family. I've always preferred a shorter hairstyle, but my mom always hesitated taking me to the salon. My short hair was ugly to them. As I grew older and less dependent on my parents, hiding my new haircuts became a necessity. I struggled to reconcile my identity with their expectations. I understand their harshness, influenced by Vietnamese cultural norms where LGBT topics are taboo. In a way, their concern was an attempt to protect me. When you live in a society that preaches anti-gay rhetoric, you too will find yourself speaking the same language. Many queer Asian Americans face similar struggles, navigating often queerphobic cultural expectations and personal identities. Yet, we are still our immigrant parents' wildest dreams. We are capable of greatness regardless of who we love or how we express ourselves. With a perspective, I'm Knives Nguyen.
Knives Nguyen is 18 years old and a student at UC Berkeley. Their perspective was produced by YR Media. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and digital equity initiatives to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com.
Coming up next on the California Report, unless you live under a rock, most of us see stars above us in the night sky, but rarely do we hear them. Until now, a Long Beach High School student has turned supernova data into music. I'm Mavi Bolaños. How did she do it, and what does it sound like? That's up next on the California Report.
Stargazing while listening. Hear the story and other California stories ahead at 8:51 a.m. Support for NPR today comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. The Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Texas takes its name from the Native American word Taisha, which means friend. The word comes from the Caddo tribe, whose members once lived and farmed across parts of the American South, from Arkansas and Louisiana to northeast Texas. 5 years ago, one of their historic sites and burial grounds was destroyed by a tornado. As Sean Saldana with the Texas Standard tells us, the site has just reopened.
The Caddo Mounds are an archaeological site that sit on a prairie near the Neches River in the piney woods of East Texas. The three grassy mounds here range from 4 to 20 feet tall and may have once helped support a community of about 200. Archaeologists believe they were used for ceremonies, burials, and temples. And for generations, they have drawn people in from across Texas.
I used to come here as a kid. We had school trips out here, so I thought I'd bring my son.
Adam Page is here for the reopening of the only prehistoric site operated by the Texas Historical Commission. His son Ethan is getting to throw spears with an atlatl. Turns out Ethan is pretty good with ancient hunting tools.
I saw you pop that hay bale about three times.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel you did?
Good, but not terrible, because I still missed about more than half my shots.
This day, it's sunny, around 90 degrees, and the mood at Caddo Mounds is cheerful.
But 5 years ago, disaster struck when a powerful tornado hit the site on Caddo Culture Day, an annual celebration in honor of the indigenous community that called this place home. The museum on site was entirely destroyed. One person died and some 40 were badly injured, including several who had to be airlifted to a hospital.
I was in the building closest to where the tornado hit.
Victor Galan is an archaeologist and a member of the Friends of Caddo Mounds, a nonprofit that helps maintain and promote the site.
I was basically picked up with the tornado and slammed down on my head or into a wall head first, and that paralyzed me from the shoulders down.
Right after the disaster, Texas lawmakers quickly allocated $2.5 million to rebuild. And after 5 years of reconstruction, the Caddo Mounds have a new museum, visitor center, and replica grass house. One of the big events of the day was a performance by five Caddo drummers who played for a crowd of some 200. Like many native communities, the Caddo have a strong oral tradition that's kept alive by people like Michael Meeks, who was one of the drummers.
The song that we sang was our Caddo veteran song. We sing that to honor all of our veterans for the sacrifices they've made.
The grand reopening of the Caddo Mounds finished with the tour led by Victor Galan, who guides a crowd of about 30 in his electric wheelchair.
Everyone who's interested in the archaeological tour, we're about to start. We're going to go on the trails behind.
He explains that here, Caddo farmed crops such as maize, squash, and tobacco. Archaeologists have worked on this site for decades, but Galan notes that much of early Caddo life is still a mystery.
There are things that we don't like to say will never be found, but there are things that are very hard or maybe nigh impossible to find.
Historic sites like the Caddo Mounds are a reminder that long before Europeans set foot in the area, civilization existed in the Americas. For NPR News, I'm Sean Saldana in East Texas.
This is NPR News.
And your California report in just a minute after we find out about traffic in Oakland.
880 northbound after High Street, the left lane blocked by a two-car crash. It's stop and go back to Marina Boulevard. In San Francisco, just endless problems. 101 northbound's connector to northbound 280. It looks like there's a grass fire burning under the freeway. They've closed the left lane there to try to put it out. Traffic is stopped back to Bayshore Boulevard. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health. To love San Francisco is not to only embrace its diversity, but to celebrate it. That's why UCSF Health provides care designed for the unique needs of each patient. To learn more, visit ucsfhealth.org/withlove. And the Exploratorium Extraordinary is a new exhibition of incredible art made from shoes, light bulbs, Lego, and more. Opens June 13th at Pier 15. Tickets at exploratorium.edu/extra. The time now is 8:51.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Evie Bolaños in San Francisco, and here's a story we've been following since last year when this cute little critter made headlines. Dubbed 841, this Santa Cruz otter captured everyone's attention when she started chasing swimmers and snatching surfboards.
Then she disappeared in December just as those atmospheric storms came through and big waves were hitting the coast, and you know, everybody kept an eye out for her, but she was gone.
That's Suzanne Rust, an environmental reporter with the LA Times. She says on Memorial Day weekend, the Santa Cruz celebrity made a return.
And from what I've seen, photos that were put on social media, she did hop on at least one surfboard, if not more than one.
Rust says this outlandish behavior is not common in sea otters, but can be found in people from Santa Cruz.
She's a complete rascal, and here she is, you know, in Santa Cruz, which is known for its rascaliness, you know, outlaws, offbeat folk, people who don't like the law. You know, federal officials and state officials tried several times last year to capture her, and they couldn't do it. So, you know, just everything she does, I think, has really tapped into the Santa Cruz psyche. I mean, she's a celebrity. You see her everywhere.
Wildlife officials say if you see her or any other otter in the water, you should try to avoid them. And in Washington, D.C., Congressman Vince Fong is getting used to his new digs. KVPR's Joshua Yeager caught up with the House's newest member, who shared his vision for the Central Valley.
Fong is settling into Capitol Hill.
I'm sitting in my office right now. Certainly need to put up some artwork or some decorations in the office, but I'm just honored to have a desk and a phone and a computer.
It's an office once held by his former mentor, Kevin McCarthy, as the 20th District Representative. The Republican steps into a deeply divided Congress, where the GOP is clinging to the slimmest of majorities. But that didn't seem to faze Fong, who says he's reaching across the aisle to deliver results for the Central Valley.
We are working on legislation when it comes to our universities, making sure that we are making the investments in our military installations, so keeping our hospitals open. Transportation, of course, is number one when it comes to our quality of life.
But Fong won't have much time to savor his new position. One more election in November, that's four this year, if you aren't counting, determines who will take the seat in the next congressional term. For the California Report, I'm Joshua Yeager in Bakersfield.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, investing in California's underserved children and youth. Hint, fruit-infused water with no sugar or diet sweeteners. Hint's 25 flavors include blackberry, coconut, and blueberry lemon, in stores or at hintwater.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at schmidtocean.org.
There are stars exploding all around us. They burst, flash, and fade. Some leave visions of their spectacular journeys in telescopes. But now we can hear them too. A high school student recently turned supernova data into a piece of music. KQED science reporter Danielle Venton introduces us to her.
A supernova is basically a star death.
Meet Vanya Agrawal. She was a senior this year at Palo Verdes High School, west of Long Beach.
So when a star reaches the end of its life, it loses all of the matter, collapses within itself, and then explodes in a great, beautiful explosion.
For a science class, she decided to take new data from a project hosted at Caltech's Palomar Observatory called the Zwicky Transient Facility.
The data that they're collecting is some of the best supernova data that we have today. And I thought it would be really interesting to be able to turn something that hasn't really been seen in the public in this type of way into a sonification.
Into this piece of music. Represented in the data is a supernova's redshift caused by light traveling away from Earth and luminosity or brightness.
And I converted each of those things into musical features such as pitch and volume of the note. So I had 8,000 data points that I used, and that translated to 8,000 notes within my composition.
Then the more interpretive, artistic side of the project.
I was able to add modifications in order to make the piece more musical. I added things like rhythms, chords, ambiance, sound effects, and these were all things to make it sound like lo-fi and sci-fi music.
Agrawal's goal was to create a piece of lo-fi or low-fidelity music, something that would be good to meditate or study to, or something that would be at home in a sci-fi movie.
Okay, I can hear Alice Coltrane's harp coming in. This is so funny. Who knew space was so peaceful?
Andrew Gilbert is a Berkeley-based arts and culture journalist who I asked to listen to the composition.
Okay, space has a beat. Space has a little bit of a groove. I like her version of space. You think of space as intimate and vast. That felt kind of intimate and lulling and inviting, conducive to getting into a good headspace.
Agrawal used it herself when she was writing her research paper.
Just for a personal experiment, let me test how this works as lo-fi study music. And it was effective.
It's also been a hit among astronomers and astrophysicists and at science fairs. Agrawal made it all the way from a district to a county to a state to even an international science fair this spring. And she's continuing to collaborate with Zwicky and Caltech.
We're really trying to create a method of sonification that's easy and accessible for anyone of any experience level. And I think this can have a lot of really great applications in getting people more interested in scientific research and feeling a greater connection to research that they might otherwise not have had an interest in.
After this summer, she heads to Washington University in St. Louis, where she plans a dual major in music composition, which she's long had an interest in.
I've been doing like Indian classical dance since I was 4, and I've been studying like different forms of like Indian classical music. I've been in like marching band, jazz band, orchestra.
And astrophysics. She thinks every kid goes through a phase of being amazed by the stars. She was just lucky enough to realize she enjoyed the mathematics of space too. Her future career, she hopes, will combine these two loves. She graduates high school today. On Earth and in headphones, I'm Danielle Venton for the California Report.
And that is the California Report for Thursday, June 6th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio.